Thank you.
If we start by moving this table forward, not because it's any great symbolic significance to it, but I hope the reading's going to be as good as the announcement. I'll start off by reading the first part of a two sets of proverbs. Invented proverbs, the idea coming from Blake's Proverbs of Heaven and Hell. These are the proverbs of the meadow and the mountain. I'll start off by reading Proverbs of the Meadow. The glory of the sunflower will eclipse the sun. Spring winds teach spring winds. In the forest's pool, tree rings are ripples. Heart and hind. The metronome is accurate, but the sundial is fitful. Pollen sleeps in the heart of the pebble. The hours are thistledown, the days are swallows. Eye bright, meadow sweet. One bramble fills the wren's eye. When the river runs straight, the furrow will meander. On a hillside leap, in a meadow sleep. The shadow of evening absorbs the shadows of day. I'll read three poems about gardens, about different kinds of gardens. In Tony's very capable introduction, he talked about the fact that I was involved for a long time in found poetry. And the whole idea this began as a very young writer. I mean, not that I'm a very old writer now, but quite a few years ago, when I started writing, I was perplexed by the idea that a writer was somebody who had something to say, who expressed himself in the way that's a popular idea of any artist, as somebody who expresses deep feelings and so forth. And my great perplexity over this matter was that I didn't have anything to say or to express. So I got that. Over the years, I started to discover that this was quite a good thing, because really, as a writer, I'm much more interested in the things that I don't know about, rather than the things that I do know. I don't know that one would continue to write if it was just a matter of saying what one already knew. Anyway, that's digressing from the fact that in the sort of found poem thing, one little area of language that I discovered was the language of popular botany. Partly because I'd moved to the country, I didn't know anything about wildflowers, and I started to learn their names, but then there was a whole kind of language which was involved with flowers and gardens and landscapes and so forth, which at first seemed to me a kind of specialised area of language, which I later discovered absolutely central language of the whole tradition of English poetry. Over the years, I've written a number of poems about gardens of different kinds. The garden as a retreat, or as a symbol for order, and so forth. A poem that I've referred to a lot through these garden poems is perhaps the greatest garden poem in the language is Andrew Marvin's poem, The Garden. in the center of that poem, there's two lines where he talks about annihilating all that's made to a green short and a green shade. I've done various variations or homages to Andrew Marvel, the latest and most essential of which can be purchased here this evening. An earlier one is fairly straightforward. It's also called The Garden. It takes off from Marvel's poem. Green thought, green shade. Blue thought, blue shade. Yellow thought, yellow shade. Red thought, red shade. Blue thought, green shade. Yellow thought, blue shade. Red thought, yellow shade. Green thought, red shade. Yellow thought, green shade. Red thought, blue shade. Green thought, yellow shade. Blue thought, red shade. Red thought, green shade. Green thought, blue shade. Blue thought, yellow shade. Yellow thought, red shade. Red thought, red shade. Yellow thought, yellow shade. Blue thought, blue shade. Green thought, green shade. Rather a long introduction for a very short poem. But it saves a lot of talk about the next one, which is in fact a found poem, a found prose poem about a Japanese garden. Tony mentioned that I was interested in Zen and in Japanese poetry and so forth. And this ties in with that. The whole poem comes, all the sentences of the poem are taken verbatim from a manual on Japanese gardening. And when I thought about it later, this is very appropriate because, in fact, lots of Japanese gardens are found gardens or use found elements in the sense that the gardener goes out and finds various rocks which he brings back and places in his garden, sort of configurations and so forth. It's really what I've done in the poem. It's called Pebbles from a Japanese Garden. I suppose I should mention that the original manual was published in Japan and was written in a peculiar form of Japanese English, which I've preserved. Pebbles from a Japanese garden. The writer designed this garden as a garden of the island of eternal youth when he was young. The writer aimed at the simplicity in designing this garden. The gardening does not always require an elaborate design. In some cases, it will agree with the will of heaven to do as little work as possible, the writer thinks. A path from the hill, a path from the right leads to the miniature hill. Wooden steps were sporadically placed in the path, but the slope was a little steep in order to prevent the slipping. The trees on the right near the house is a wild maple tree, which serves as the scenery object to be viewed from the room and provides the shady nook. The arbor entrance for noble men is seen. The tree near a room should not be too big, for a too big tree will give dwellers an overwhelmed sensation. The creeping in on knees entrance of the small room to be used for tea ceremonies is equipped with a step stone. To wash his hands, one has to take a step from the stepping stones down on a rock in front of the basin, and thus it is also called the stepping down type wash basin. By taking one step down from the stepping stones, he will feel a more profound solitude. It might be effective that big and bulky rocks were not used in order to attract the attention of viewers to the limpid pond. Two sharp creases of rocks in everyday circumstances will make dwellers nervous. Bamboo grasses peeping from the joints between the mossed stonets abound in rustic beauty. The rock in the middle is a good example of the use of a rock, the root of which is stretching. Small cobbles covering the bottom of brook have been temporarily taken away for the sweeping. Pebbles should be put in the middle of the bottom of hole in order to eliminate puddle. As a part of the distant sea was visible from the main house, two red pines were planted so as to lean to the sea in order to soften the brightness of the sea. It would be nice to place a table and chairs near the seashore and take tea, enjoying the scenery. In order to afford a pleasant prospect to the visiting old folks, a bridge painted with vermilion was built, a bridge painted with vermilion was built over the pond, which was filled with clear water and bordered with blue rocks. Ripples in the pond are caused by raindrops. Water lilies in a pond should not be too much, and they should be thinned if they overgrows to stretch out their pads above the water. This area is an application of the beauty of contents of symbol to produce the atmosphere of a wild field. When they feel the delicate fragrance of roses from the facial expression and the body of the sculpture. From time to time, beautiful birds were seen tritting on leaves on the ground with rustling sound. Everything in the surrounding of a person taking rest is in trim order. Earthy thoughts will not rise in him. It's the third garden poem. It's called An Epicurean Garden. After Walter Pater. after Walter Pater, because all the phrases of the poem are taken from Walter Pater's book, Horace the Epicurean. As everybody, of course, knows, the philosopher Epicurus was used to walk in his garden with his disciples, discussing his philosophy, and it's a continuing theme of English poetry, the garden has been space for contemplation, so forth. An Epicurean Garden, after Walter Pater. The oak of an immemorial age, the rock fashioned by weather. The shadowy grove of ilex, the old wooden gods. The upright stone, the great portico, the dry paths, the scrupulous ways. The velvet of mosses, the young myrtles in flower, the distant fragrance, the clean lustral water. The last breeds of morning mist, the sheep that pasture, the abandoned boat, the long summer days of idleness. the one level space of the horizon, the fairy of sunshine, the pensive tone, the solemn outline of dark hills, the urbanities, the graceful forms, the austere sky, the clear song of the blackbird, the ray of sunlight, the cool brown shadows, the hardness of stone, the chaplet of roses, the absolute transparency of air, the blue gentians, the drift of flowers, the allotted hours, the hoary roots and trunks, the abundant sound of water, the already mouldering travertine, the precious marbles, the dream of perfect music, the clear blue humours of the eye, the fragrant borders, the sepulchral inscriptions, the unseen violet, the wattled edge roses, the natural wildness, the delicate sinuosities, the trace of some celestial wave, the ascetic gloom, the numerous cascades, the olive gardens, the little hollows and ravines, the placid spaces of evening. I was reading somewhere or other the other day, I'm going to be told that this is this fact's wrong, but it's a wee bit of erudition, so I've got to trot it out, that apparently in German, a poet is known as a Dichter, and poetry is Dichtung, which apparently means to condense. A poet is a condenser of language. I say that as a sort of excuse, because the next little series of poems are one-word poems. This is a form that was developed by a Scottish poet, Ian Hamilton of Finlay, and he defined the form as being a one-word poem is a poem which consists of one word, but the title can be of any length. I'm afraid that the titles aren't very long, are they? One word poem. A word written upon marble. Dawn. An affinity of eye and petal. Iris. A sampler of simple stitches. Summer. A palette of watercolours, horizon, a vasculum of daisies, memory, an aromatic seasoning, thyme, a rudimentary bud, eye. Neat Norwegian horizon, spruce. Sad Scotch horizon, pine. Legend for a garden pond, reflections. A night-scented water lily, moon. I should use that to prove that I could actually write things, even if they're only one word long. But having done that, I'll go back to found stuff again. This is a prose poem about photography, since there are a few of them. But you may be interested in this, because it's photography in the open air. All the sentences, again, were taken verbatim from an early manual of open air photography. And the poem is called Photography in the Open Air. A bit of background noise. A hand camera should be habitually carried on walks in the country. For it is impossible to tell what will turn up next. And the necessity for silent movement is obvious. But there is equal advantage to be derived from the wearing of dull-coloured clothes and the power of remaining motionless. Since in stalking, the camera is brought as near as possible either to the object or to the place it is to occupy, it may be necessary, in certain cases, to disguise the camera or the operator or both. What seems requisite is an eye which is sensitive to small distinctions of form and colour, which can distinguish a bird's nest from the hedge where it is lodged. A power of observation confined to material fact without the disturbing influence of ethics. When the wind ruffles the heather, one pair of eyes may detect a movement which is not due to the wind. An attempt should be made to obtain apparatus of such a simple character that the hands can be trained to manipulate it automatically while the eyes are employed elsewhere. The writer is unable to enter on the vexed question of lenses with any degree of authority. It should be remembered, however, that the intelligence behind the lens has a greater effect on the finished result than the lens itself. Mice of all kinds are excellent subjects for the camera. They must be taken life-size if a picture is to be of any value. For when the image is a minute one, there is a risk of losing the delicate shadows on the fur, which contrast so well with the brilliant eyes. If we propose to analyse animal movement, to study the various positions of the quill feathers in the flight of a bird, instant exposures are essential. But the resulting pictures will not represent what we see with our eyes. The breathing of reptiles in times of distress or agitation is of a most erratic character. The writer has observed, in the case of a toad, two short gasps, a long gasp, then a pause of varying duration, after which the first movement is repeated. This pause is obviously what the photographer should wait for. The lizard, sunning himself on a stone, strikes delightful attitudes, but seldom maintains them for long enough to have them perpetuated. The whole life of newts seems dominated by the spirit of unrest. The ability to take a snapshot while riding a bicycle is most useful to the natural. The simplest method is to suspend the camera around the neck and keep one hand free to work the shutter. 'Tis in the recording of what does not endure, of fleeting impressions and momentary gestures, that the future of photography assuredly lies. Read from my new publication called Four Sonnets. The reason I read from this is to discover if there are any spelling mistakes all the way.
Well, actually, we read it down the margins first.
That's a good one. This is part of a work in progress. I suppose there's sort of seven or eight of them written so far. I only have the four with me. They're called Four Sonnets because they've got, each has got 14 lines, or at least they had when they left my mind. I don't think that traditionalists will find them sonnets in their own. Four sonnets. What the day weaves, the night unravels. Here in the forest, all roads run broad. What the weaver knows, the forest soon undoes. All roads lose themselves in the warp and woof. Somewhere in the poem, a stag should enter, but the stag is lost at a crossroad of sunbeams. What the poem weaves, the forest will unravel. Blue, yellow, and green, things are what they seem. Every object absorbs all colours but its own. Each leaf shining as if varnished by the breeze. Yellow, green and blue, that which is possible do hold to the lavender walk between estrangences. Green and blue and yellow, one summer makes a swallow under the glittering eaves. A swiftness is flesh. I will pick the smooth yarrow, that my voice may be gladder, that my words may be arrows, that my syllables be hard as tide-tossed pebbles. May I be an island in the sea, may blue sea asters cover me, may I leap upon the hillside. I will grasp the spear thistle, that no man shall wound me, may no rumour find me. I will weave the thistle down, I will be a wind-blown reed, my songs will lure the sun. Our boat touches the bank, among a scent of bruised sedge. The startled heron rises, broken from his austerities. We are in a proud country where stone chats to stone, where forest pods crackle open, grey grouse and curlews in form. Keep well below the horizon, your flesh spare upon the bone. Trust to flintlock and sabre, bed down among the heather. The wild fill music of the air, tuneless will find you anywhere. It's time for another one. I read, to begin with, I read the Proverbs of the Meadow. These are the Proverbs of the Mountain. The Muses inhabit the mountains. Bindweed and blind worm write their names. The old straight track is unfrequented. Behind the white blossom, the black thorn. To the mountain's stature at a single pebble. Clarity is not attendant on altitude. Wit starches the wren's tail. The sheep path holds to expedience. Bind weed, loose strife. A flower may break a rock. Vowels and consonants clear water over pebbles. The berry of nightshade is bittersweet. Another poem about gardening. This one needs a wee bit of explanation, or else it's really somewhat arcane. The most influential writer on gardens in late Victorian times was a lady called Gertrude Jekyll. And she was slightly older, though roughly contemporaneous, with another writer called Gertrude Stein, who didn't particularly write about gardens, but occasionally did. And this work, for no other reason than the fact that they're both called Gertrude, is a poem which takes the words of Gertrude Jekyll and rearranges them in the style of Gertrude Stein. Gertrude Stein, one of her most controversial works was called Tender Buttons. And this piece is called Tansy Buttons. Tansy Buttons. One distinctly advises a kind of ordered informality. One distinctly advises ferns. One distinctly advises both native and exotic. One distinctly advises a dry wall. To know what to place where and when to stop. To know what it is well to let alone. Such discretion. In older days it was so. Picture complete in the still water, on summer evenings, the shadow. A quiet progress just happened to come so. A unity presents no shock. It often comes of a want of space, and only a certain space is given. The path rises gently, doing something and then passing to some other. Thoroughly well and just sufficient. Speak of a blue. It must have sun and air and full exposure. Its colour may be said to be blue. A neat, bushy blue. It will thrive and flower abundantly. It can never be repeated too often that the very best effects are made with the simplest means. It can never be repeated too often. Confused and crowded is a fold, a chance patchwork. We paint with living plants and the simplest means. It can never be repeated too often. When the yuccas are in flower, the Ayrshire roses are delightful. Here is also tansy. It is a plant that will grow. It is a plant that makes a considerable show. Hard yellow flower. At the edge of pond or pool, here is also tansy.
asking oneself why this and why that, giving plenty of time to each little plant and asking oneself, taking a light seat to the rock wall and giving plenty of time to each little plant. When it thought then one sees, they open more and lie a little flatter. It's a good rule to make the steps so easy that one can run up and down them. Nothing is pleasanter than all the various ways. One is more than ever bound to the practice of the most severe restraint. Violet, iris, jasmine, and vine. Accept nothing that does not, in its own place and way, satisfy. Iris, poppy, jasmine, and vine. The serene contentment of an absolute. All the way down, there would be the living water, rippling, rushing, falling. In little steps of falls, its rippling music. And in the same way, throughout the garden, trifling, catching, guiding. Not a muddle of means that disposed might compose. I do not say it is easy. Any bare spaces can be filled with places whose presence is a comfort. The little garden is planted. This one is called The Homecoming, and the title comes from a poem by the German poet Hölderlin. The first line of the poem is a quotation from Hölderlin. The Homecoming. What you see. South and the sweet grass, the separate hills and the silver waters, the main stream and the beaten track, the short cut and the thin wind, the careless tune and the strict measure, the bright glade and the busy silence, the desolate moor and the fine prospect, the tumbling brook and the standing stone, the hard road and the pleasant path, the steady light and the turning page, the lucid leaf and the placid water, the broken boat and the clear the bilberry slope and the gathered cloud, the rock pool and the fern's blossom, the pipe smoke and the slow dawn, the startled deer and the dappled shadow, the ripened fruit and the chance meeting, the keen air and the floating gossamer, the passing word and the laden branches, the pebbled bed and the yellow flag, the weather vane and the straight furrow, the slender birch and the tangled briar, the foul field and the constant sun, the fragrant pine and the welling spring, the fallen lintel and the thistle patch, the smooth snake and the bracken tide, the hollow way and the parsley flower.
series that I'm writing will be a small book of prose poems, which I think will be called Sentences. The various sections of the book, there's a section called Horizons, a section called Islands, a section called Light. This section is called Pebbles. Pebbles. The great delight of the pebble collector is to discover upon a beach of indifferent flotsam and wrack that single specimen which the tides of his expectation have long worn smooth. How will one choose how will one choose a pebble from a beach of pebbles? The choice is usually a conglomerate of accident and design, of circumspection and indifference. Now and then a pebble will start up to the eye through some encrusted calligraphy as if it bore one's name. Words wash over the pebble like a tide. Many words alter the shape of the pebble. The pebble collector is alert to small distinctions of weight, shape, and tone, yet he knows nothing of geology. For him, the pebble does not take flight into any past or future, but comes fresh at each moment to his hand and eye. The hard little pieces of his perceptions never accumulate into learning. Pebble. The tongue stumbles over the word. It is a noun indifferent to all verbs. It will not be reduced to whatever we would say about it. When one has named the pebble, it is already too much. The collector of pebbles is one who conceives of himself principally as a lack, a frequenter of wastes and margins. He has not learned to live without the last shard of consolation. There are pebbles of such a perfect uniformity that they offer no purchase to the affection. The poverty of a pebble is too complete to be salutary. No one would take its condition for a touchstone. Any tide or current may turn a pebble, and only chance preserves it by lifting it out of the flow. Only chance or the arbitrary hand of the collector. A pebble is not a precious stone. To polish a pebble is to lack respect for its native diffidence, to offer it the further humiliation of esteem. The pebble will not be interrogated. It allows the elements to surround it with a decent rind. In spite of its self-containment, the pebble is the opposite of a mystery. It submits itself entirely to the embrace of gravity. When a pebble is held in the hand, it is possessed completely. To come across a satisfying pebble may take hours of searching or a few moments only. It will weigh slightly more than we had expected. It will rest in the palm more easily than we could have imagined. Yet beyond these felicities, forming from a sediment of distinctions, is the pebble we will never find. The single pebble one carries them away from the beach may be a rare discovery or something altogether common. It may be given a prominent place on the mantelpiece or lie forgotten in the pocket. The pebble is as hard and complete as a poem. It is as discreet as a poem. Like a poem too, it may be pitted and scarred by wind and weather. The pebble remains faithful to the mountain. On a wide stretch of beach, the pebble is anonymous, yet a shaft of sunlight may single it out. Content to remain where the elements have left it, it can be made to dance on the back of a lake. The taste of a freshwater pebble defeats metaphor. The evening is either long or short. A trout leaps, a carnivore calls. The pebbles lie under limpid water. To say that the white pebble waits for the stream to wash it to the sea, for the tides to reduce it to sand, is quite inaccurate. It does not wait. It is neither patient nor impatient. Explain to you how the thing was made. There was a sort of discipline behind the poem, which consisted of taking a page of Ruskin from, I think I used the Stones of Venice and modern painters. And from each page, I produced a tiny fragment. This was used by maybe reading down margins or taking one word from here and there so that none of the actual results bear any relation to Ruskin's except insofar as the themes are Ruskin's and the language is his. The idea being to, since I said earlier that I'm not the sort of writer who gives you anything to say, one was using a very restricted set of words and seeing what one could come up with from that. The poem is written in five. All of that bears no relation whatsoever to the actual finished result. But the poem is in five sections, and each section, the title of each section is the title of an essay by Ruskin. A Ruskin sketchbook. Part one is called The Material of Ornament. To be of stone under the calm blue sky, the apparent heaven the sun shapes for us as it sets and rises. Tying the shafts in a lover's knot. Not the placing of symmetries our purpose, but to look forth for tidings. To look round in the world and discover architecture. I give the reader the ground and stones that he may build for himself. The stones of which the hard world is built, good marble or granite, smooth sheets of rock that ring under the hammer, thin courses of cloven shale, like a crushed heap of autumn leaves. to make of these spaces what we choose, and in so doing, to increase and diminish. Heart's content, restraining ornament, so-called flutings, line after receding line, tracery of acanthus and vine. For every blossom that roots itself in rock, summer rains, for ivy, rose, and for the oak. A palette prepared for us, all shades and hues, broken, mixed, and mingled. Letting shadow into the light, letting light into the shade. Into the tiniest stamen, the commandment is written. Continence at the root, the rest is liberty. A kind of darkness in the iris. Through the clearness of it, flaws will show. The wheat blight, the wild grass grow. That the affections be vivid, such hawthorn you will try to gather. Part two is called Of Water as Painted by the Ancients. A commonplace roadside pond, reflecting nothing but the morning sky. The roads wind to it, the trees nod to it, the horizon slopes to it, the eye scampers towards it. Look deep and you may see the passing of pure clouds, these tremulous islands, sun-lighted spaces, a crystalline patience, drinking cattle cast an unstirred image. A bird stooping to drink a very muddy sunshine. In every ripple, those dazzling fields expanding, on level water, these days of idleness. Bright sunlight beyond all painting. Three is called Of Truth of Tone. Walking in sunbeams, the most precious distance between us. Serenity of light partitioned by walls, where the bridge crosses the descending stream of light, a traveller washing his feet, a little fountain breaking at the mountain's foot, trickling away in triplets. Accidental sunbeams reflect refractions, transparency, to be gathered into a space apparently small. One simple blaze of light behind the old oak, a change of the eye so slight, isolated touches of morning light, breathing animated, exulting light, equal on all things, from rock to rock, leaf to leaf, leaping, glowing, flashing. Every bush, every stone, every tuft has its voice. Lusters of light that linger in furrows of fleece. The valley in showers of light, every separate leaf quiver. Green vistas arch like hollows of some crystalline sea. The highest lights and the deepest darks agree. A thousand evergreens in sulphurous blue, the green of a growing leaf, the scarlet of a fresh flower, no art nor expedient. Between these absolutely necessary facts, the sobered truths of time. Flesh patient, waiting the sickle. Forest fern leads straw, sharp, small, penetrative sympathies. Rusty, dusty, tar-trickled, fishy, phosphorescent brown, old bunt. Letting the vine and the river twine, and the black fruit swell in the sunshine. Plowed darkness, root gold. The leaf borders. Where rending is a law of being, these torn leaves. Fretted, fringed, cleft, furrowed, serrated, sinuated. All accidents of the branch, new ways of getting out to the sun. The bending trunk above the waterfall, some such indifference. A branch of any tree, meeting currents, making way. A prevalently upright tendency with a capacity of branching. The root mining through darkness, its green crest in the air. At times forgotten, hands take thorns. A little cascade, so light, falls, shaking itself in the sun. Ragged, together in decay, the simplicities withered away. No words to tell of green fiber into fitful change. Of imagination penetrative. The dull, wandering world. Nothing more nor less. The things seen, such things as these. No care to know anything but these, the one with the other. What we want is fleeting, flitting, fading, no measure but that momentary glance. A little while, a moment, part of this mountain. Once shaped, it is shaped. In marble, the means of marble. The stains and strelae of marble and wood. No ideas beyond knots. Mind's tongue that tastes into the very rock. Waters out of the rock, the main force of a fact. The quiet water which fills the hollows of the hills. Every crack and fissure, a decision of language. Sharp, fresh, frost-split fragments, weather rounds them, tolerantly smooth. Delight grows, the sweet plant pleasure. The very root of delight, necessity. The gold and the clay eating each other. Virtues, duties, species of moss to necessary stone. dark relieved against light, refreshment after sorrow. The distilled silence, the brightened syllables. Light enters a lance through the heart, nailing the head to the place it occupies. Horizon's compass, a discipline. Amber, lustrous, fitful brightness, laying quiet finger on the trembling stone.